Moscow is targeting Ukraine as well as any Russian media that are not parroting the Kremlin's line. Russia's last independent newspaper is folding up.
And now it's over. It was predicted and we all expected that it's going to happen, but now it's over. And it just breaks my heart.
Also, we look at the long-term prospects in Ukraine. What happens if Russians remain as occupiers?
You know, if your car is being serviced by a Ukrainian mechanic whose family has been wiped out by the horrendous bombardments that we've been seeing, I'd wonder what would happen when I turned the ignition key on.
I'm Marco Werman, and if you need to replace your phone, Austria has a plan to help your wallet and the environment. Just fix it.
This is the best way to help us into the future, into a glorious future.
All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. Today we mark the start of week 6 of the war in Ukraine. It is an understatement to call it a tragedy for Ukraine and its people. When it comes to food and energy supplies, the war there has also been a major disruption globally. To counter that, today President Biden announced a big release of oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Today, I'm authorizing the release of 1 million barrels per day for the next 6 months.
That is the biggest release ever aimed at lowering gas prices for U.S. consumers.
Our family budgets, your family budgets, to fill a tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war.
The World's Carolyn Baylor joins me now. So, Carolyn, what impact is this likely to have on global oil markets?
Marco, this is expected to tame the increase in oil prices. We already saw a small dip today. One S&P analyst I spoke to called this release humongous, and that historic size is expected to send a bit of an outsized signal to the markets. That's what Svetlana Lobashova, an analyst with a company that arranges oil shipments, told me today.
We've never had such a big releases in the past, and we are not really expecting Russia to completely stop producing crude oil. So I think the combination of those two things will help to cool down the prices.
Are other countries likely to follow suit and put more of their oil on the market?
Yeah, that is expected. Tomorrow, the International Energy Agency is holding a meeting where they're expected to talk about additional releases from strategic reserves. But OPEC met today and decided to hold steady with their plan of only gradually increasing production, and U.S. production is mostly also holding steady. So these strategic oil reserve releases are a short-term attempt to keep prices in check, but they don't address the underlying issue of production.
Are we seeing an actual shortage of oil getting pumped out right now, or is it more of a fear of future dips in production that's driving up prices?
Well, there is not yet a decrease in the amount of oil that's actually being loaded onto ships in ports in, for example, the Baltic and Black Sea. But we are seeing two things happen. First, exports are expected to decline in the future. Many refineries say they're not going to buy future barrels of Russian oil, and sanctions are expected to kind of tangle up production within Russia. So prices are jumping in anticipation of that lowered supply in the future. And the other thing that's happening is that on the spot market for oil, traders are already refusing to buy Russian oil. So the price of Russian oil is dropping and the price of all other oil is going up.
So you cover environmental issues for the show, Carolyn. President Biden ran for office on a platform of tackling climate change. Is this a sign that he's backing away from that?
You know, it was striking in his remarks today. Biden was calling on oil companies to boost production, which is really rhetorically a marked change from the Biden who was campaigning on climate action. But he also did urge Congress today to pass his long stalled clean energy bill and noted that the key to long term energy independence was investing more in renewables.
The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Baylor, thanks very much for this update.
Thank you, Marco.
Now to the situation on the ground in Ukraine. Despite Russian promises to scale back its military offensive, today Russian forces were still targeting areas around Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. And Ukraine's president is warning that Russia is amassing more troops for a major ground and air assault in eastern Ukraine. To talk about the disconnect between what Russia is saying and what it's doing, we turned to Marie Yovanovitch. She's the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Yovanovitch also has a new book out called Lessons from the Edge. She does not think it's likely Russia is dialing back its war in Ukraine.
They've done this before in Syria. They did it in 2014 and 15 in Ukraine itself, where they use negotiations, they use the element of time to play to their advantage and change the facts on the ground. And so I do believe that what they're doing is they're digging in their tanks, artillery, mortar. That doesn't indicate to me that they're ready for true peace negotiations.
So as for how Ukraine and specifically President Volodymyr Zelensky manage this lack of honesty from the Kremlin, can you help us get inside President Zelensky's head at this moment? I mean, there are no doubt competing demands on him, both to strike a deal to end this brutal assault as soon as possible, as well as pressure from patriots not to yield an inch of Ukrainian soil and keep on fighting. How do you think he's weighing those competing demands?
Well, I think he is putting forward some constructive proposals. He's suggested that there would be a non-nuclear neutral status for Ukraine, so long as there would be international guarantees. So I think that that is a pretty important move on Zelensky's part. But the other thing that he has recognized is that for all its faults, Ukraine is a democracy. And so he wants to put this to a referendum.
Should the U.S. be providing international guarantees to protect Ukraine down the line?
I think that this is something that the administration should be looking at. I don't exactly know how that would work, what kind of guarantees, how it would work. Zelensky has also asked a number of other countries to provide guarantees. I think this is something we'd have to look at very carefully.
So as we look ahead in the months and years to come, it is very possible that European democracies could buckle under the stress of this invasion of Ukraine. I mean, already energy prices are skyrocketing. There are millions of refugees straining the resources of countries in Europe where they end up. Voters in other parts of Europe might vote out the very governments that came to Ukraine's defense. How much does that worry you?
You know, that's the job of our leaders, to ensure that resolve remains strong and to connect the dots, if you will, for why this war in what to us, I think, often seems like a remote place, it seems a lot closer to people in Europe, especially people who remember or were brought up by people who endured World War II and the massive dislocations, the bombings, the terror.
I'm speaking with former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Looking down the line, what do you foresee in Ukraine if Russia attempts to just occupy large portions of the country?
The Ukrainian people will not give up. There will be a guerrilla war. It will be ugly. And I would not want to be a Russian occupier, a soldier going into some cafe and being served by a Ukrainian waiter or waitress. I'd worry what they were serving me. Same thing with a car. You know, if your car is being serviced by a Ukrainian mechanic whose family has been wiped out by the horrendous bombardments that we've been seeing, I'd wonder what would happen when I turned the ignition key on.
Ambassador Yovanovitch, you had praise for President Zelensky earlier. You also praised President Zelensky for his wartime leadership in your book, but you also point to a time when he was not your ally. You describe a particular phone call. This was in the era when President Trump was pressuring Ukrainian officials to investigate the Biden family. You describe Zelensky as piling on and calling you a bad ambassador. Why do you think President Zelensky did not support you in that moment in time?
I knew Zelensky before he became a candidate for president and then when he was running for office. And we met a number of times and we had a perfectly normal professional relationship. I don't think he had any animosity towards me. But I think that many world leaders and many leaders right here in the United States, when dealing with Donald Trump, they pandered to his ego. They told him what he wanted to hear. And so I think Zelensky was probably just acting in that mode and probably got that advice to not irritate Donald Trump and, to the extent possible, pander to him.
So you're a diplomat, Marie Yovanovitch. I have to ask you this. You have worn, or maybe you're even wearing it right now, a bracelet. You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
You've also custom ordered a bunch of coffee mugs with, well, it basically says, F you Putin on it. For a diplomat who describes herself as state, I'm just wondering why you're stepping out of that character for this. What does that tell us about you?
I did this when I was in Ukraine, although I still have a couple left. When we had visitors from the United States, you know, whether they were congressional members or others, people were coming to show support to Ukraine. And they were also coming, in many cases, to underline that we were concerned about the Russian threat, not only in Ukraine, but more broadly. So a Ukrainian politician had given me the bracelet, and I thought, yeah, you know, because my reaction was, you know, first you're shocked and then you laugh. And then you kind of like it. And you're right, it's not very diplomatic, but it gets the point across. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to order a bunch of these and give them out and see how it goes. I found it an effective way of communicating what I think we all felt, but, you know, couldn't actually say.
Marie Yovanovitch served as a diplomat for 33 years, including as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 2016 to 2019. She served under Presidents Obama and Trump. Her new book is called Lessons from the Edge. Ambassador Yovanovitch, thank you very much for being with us. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
For the first time, an activist is going on trial in Poland for helping a woman access abortion. Last year, the Polish government introduced a near-total ban on abortions. Under that law, anyone found helping someone to terminate a pregnancy faces up to 3 years in prison. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry spoke with the activist who's about to face justice.
When Justyna Wydrenska put abortion pills into an envelope and mailed them to a woman in another part of Poland, she knew she was taking a big risk. But Wydrenska says she felt she had no other option.
I got information from our colleagues that there is a person who needs pills because she cannot go abroad. She was blackmailed by her husband that if she traveled to Germany, then he will point to the police kidnapping of her kids. So she was really afraid. So I took a decision and sent those pills.
The woman at the center of this case remains anonymous. She's been referred to in the Polish press as Ania, although that's not her real name. She had planned to go to Germany to have an abortion, but after her husband threatened to take her children, Ania reached out to the abortion support group. Providing information on abortion is not illegal in Poland. Handing out abortion pills is. Several months after she put those pills in the mail, the police showed up at Justyna Wydrenska's door.
They searched my home looking for pills. I also had one package for my own use. So they took this and also took all my devices like computer, phones, my kit for computers. So really, they check everything.
The police had received a tip from Anya's husband, who was monitoring her calls. He also took the pills away from her. Anya later had a miscarriage. Wydrenska was once in an abusive relationship herself and ended up having an abortion. She says this case reminds her of her own circumstances many years ago. In 2016, Wydrenska co-founded the activist group Abortion Dream Team. She says her organisation has always been very careful to operate within the law in Poland, but Anya's case moved her to do more. I asked Wydrenska if she's ready to go to prison.
If I receive 2 weeks in jail, I will go to jail, really, just for showing that I'm not afraid of our government.
The case is the first of its kind in Europe, where an activist is being charged with helping a woman have an abortion. Mara Clark, founder of the Abortion Support Network, says she worries that the Polish authorities are making an example out of Wydrenska as a warning to others.
The government is showing us that if you help somebody, if you help your sister or your mother or your wife or your partner or your bestie, that they're going to come for you.
But Wydrenska says whatever the court decides, her organization will not be intimidated.
No, we will not stop our work. We are so sure that our work is really important that we will not stop.
I ask Mara Clark with the Abortion Support Network what she thinks will happen if Wydrenska is sent to prison.
If they do decide to give Justyna jail time, I think the protests they saw after the Constitutional Tribunal ruling will look like child's play. And we will fight for her. They better come for us all. And there's more of us than they think.
Wydrenska says she's already in talks with the Dutch government about seeking political asylum there if she's given a full prison sentence. The trial opens in Warsaw late next week. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Coming up next, a major change at the U.S.-Mexico border for asylum seekers. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Biden administration plans to end COVID border restrictions for people trying to enter the U.S. to seek asylum. Almost since the start of the pandemic, Border Patrol agents have been able to expel migrants back to their home countries or to Mexico, a public health measure that many argue went too far for too long. Reporter Julia Preston has just returned from the Mexican border. She covers immigration for the Marshall Project. This program started by the Trump administration, Julia, is called Title 42. Remind us what changes the policy made for people who are trying to seek asylum at U.S. borders.
Under Title 42, since March of 2020, the border authorities have had the power to immediately expel migrants who cross the border without documentation. This short-circuited the entire asylum process, which under normal circumstances allows migrants to present themselves to a Border Patrol agent and say that they're afraid to return to their home countries.
So during the pandemic, it was enacted by Donald Trump in the name of public health. Did Title 42 accomplish its public health goals?
At the beginning, when the Trump administration put this order into effect, there was no significant transmission of COVID either way across the Mexican border. But 2 years later, as we know, the situation has changed very dramatically. And the concern of Title 42 was that there would be crowding in Border Patrol stations and that the Border Patrol would not have the capacity to vaccinate and protect people. So there was a time, I think, when the CDC's logic was effective, but I think there's a general agreement that now that we have vaccines and testing, that that time has passed.
I see that there is a new rule that will come online at the end of May when Title 42 is lifted. Agents themselves will make the decision instead of sending people into crowded courts. So between now and the end of May, what changes do you think will be made in the asylum process to deal with what will very likely be increasing numbers?
The Biden administration has a very hard problem on its hands here. The administration has said that it is going to be building up capacity to detain more people, to process more people, to vaccinate and test more people. But the numbers that are coming to the border this year, but really it started at the end of the Trump administration, but particularly in recent months, Marco, these are unprecedented numbers. Whether or not the administration can really get everything in place in terms of the number of agents, the public health officials that will be needed to conduct vaccinations and testing, that remains to be seen.
What about those informal and often dangerous and inhospitable camps on the other side of the border where people have ended up because of Title 42? What will likely happen there?
Well, those people have been waiting, in most cases, for months, if not years, for an opportunity to cross the border and approach a Border Patrol agent and state that they are afraid to return to their home countries and begin the process of an asylum claim. What the Biden administration will do now, starting in May, is a complete change in the way the asylum system has worked, in that you will have an asylum officer, an individual officer, who will be stationed somewhere close to the border, who will actually make the first decision about whether or not to grant asylum to that person. So the administration is cutting out the whole process of the immigration courts, which have been so backlogged that they almost have become dysfunctional. And so whether or not the administration can get all those officers in place by May, it's a very heavy lift.
Julia Preston covers immigration for the Marshall Project, giving us some scenarios for the next couple of months as the Biden White House gets ready to lift the border restriction known as Title 42. Julia, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ever had this happen? Your computer printer breaks down and it's more expensive to repair than replace it, so to the trash it goes. In case it wasn't evident, this churn of electronic waste is terrible for the environment. Austria is trying to do something about that. It's starting a program next month called the Repair Bonus. The government will give people a credit of up to 200 euros, that's about $222, to repair broken appliances. Welcome news for people like Sepp Eisenriegeler in Vienna. He owns one of Austria's largest electronics repair centers. I asked him what stuff is covered by the repair bonus.
It's for all electrical and electronic devices. Even e-bikes are concerned. And we, as repair service providers, do not charge the customers the whole sum. We just ask them for 50%. And the rest we get from the Ministry for Climate Protection.
In addition to trashing something that could have more life in it if it's repaired, isn't there also the initial cost and carbon output of making the appliance in the first place? So by trashing item A and then replacing it with item B, you're doubling up. So how much would the repair bonus reduce that carbon outlay?
This is true for all the electronic stuff we buy and throw away, that the cheap products are not really cheap. I give you an example. If you buy a washing machine for 300 euros, it is technically designed to last for 3 years. If you want to have 20 years clean laundry, you would need 7 of those washing machines, which cost you more than 2,000 euros. If you buy one high-end washing machine, which costs 1,000 euros, you can have all these 20 years clean laundry with only one item. And so, all in all, the cheap items are double as expensive as the high-end one.
So I know, Sepp, that you've been an advocate for what's known as the circular economy. Explain what that is.
What we do in the circular economy, we fight the trend against the reduction of the lifetimes of electrical and electronic devices. One example, in former days, we bought washing machines for half a lifetime, let's say for 30 years. I myself am doing my laundry with a 40-year-old Miele washing machine. And this is the way where we have to return to. Nowadays, washing machines are used 8.3 years on the average. On a saturated market, you have to reduce the lifetime. That's very logical. And I don't blame the producers for doing so. It's a system failure. It's not their fault.
So looking in the future, in Austria, more people might be willing now to repair their electronics. But are there enough skilled people in Austria ready to repair them?
Yeah, that's a sort of a bottleneck. We have to build up an infrastructure for serious repair services. So we have offered since 1 year the so-called social franchising system. We want to give all our know-how to others who will do that on their own, and then we can cope with the growing demand. But I'm not sure that we alone will make it. So I would like to get in touch with people who want to be independent repairers and follow our business case also in the USA.
Sepp Eisenriegele is the owner of the Repair and Service Center in Austria. He's been speaking with us from Vienna. Thank you very much for joining us, Sepp.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. If there's ever a time to visit Japan, it's now, because cherry blossoms are in full bloom. Translation, life has finally gotten back to normal. And behind those pink blossoms is a lot of data, 13 centuries worth of information to help researchers better understand the impacts of climate change. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. It is happening again in Somalia. The country is on the brink of famine. In 2011, more than 250,000 people in Somalia died of starvation. UN officials are now warning that the country is facing the worst drought to hit the Horn of Africa in more than 40 years. At least 500,000 people in Somalia have already left their homes due to insufficient food and water. From Luke, Somalia, the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
It's dry and dusty on the outskirts of the town of Luke in southern Somalia. People have traveled far to reach this camp for internally displaced people, one of nearly three dozen in this district. The carcasses of dead livestock rot in 100-degree weather. Like most of Somalia, there's been little to no rain here for three consecutive seasons. That has led hundreds of thousands of people to leave their homes in search of food and water. 22-year-old Ade Ibrahim Wado is a recent arrival. Everyone is on the move, Wado says, searching for help after our livestock all died. Wado and her family traveled for days to get to this camp in hopes of receiving help. But when they arrived, they found that the river nearby had nearly dried up. Wado says the only assistance she's received so far is a mat donated by the local community. She sleeps on it with her nine family members under a temporary shelter made of wood, plastic, and bits of cloth. Wado tells me she arrived here with two young children, carrying one on her back and the other in her arms. She says she's desperate to find food for them. The lack of food and water has already caused their hair to turn yellow. I know it's because they're malnourished, she tells me. Because of this drought, the number of malnourished children are shooting up. That's why the UN is sounding the alarm about a possible famine. Fatima Mohammed is an aid worker with the Irish NGO Trokra. At a local health clinic, she tells me the situation for a lot of newly internally displaced people, or IDPs, is dire.
Majority of them come with the children very malnourished, the mothers very malnourished as well. I remember recently a mother who had walked all the way from Elwak to the IDP center. It was the IDP, which is near the town. As soon as she arrived, the poor mother passed on. Her child was still breastfeeding her.
The drought is to blame, she adds. Many people on the move are pastoralists who depend on raising livestock, but now they're seeing their cattle, goats, sheep, and even camels all die. That means people no longer have a source for milk, meat, or income.
The few animals they come with, that is what you are seeing now. They were perishing as they arrived here. And those are the type of people, you know, who, when they arrive, they need all kinds of assistance. Unfortunately, the speed at which assistance has been coming has been slower.
The UN says it's raised less than 4% of the money needed to avert a humanitarian disaster in Somalia. Funding is stretched thin across the country in camps, villages, and hospitals. At one hospital in Luke Town, the malnutrition ward is full of sick children and their guardians receiving health care. Baro Hassan is holding her 2-year-old granddaughter. They're both thin and weak. The toddler's health is improving after being here for a few days, says Hassan. She became malnourished and sick because of the lack of food in the village. Her skin has become infected because of her weakened immune system. Hassan tells me she's experienced drought before, but never like this. One that killed all of the animals. But when her granddaughter is better, she tells me they will return to their village because there's nowhere else to go. For some in Somalia, assistance has come too late. There are already some reports of people dying due to lack of food and water, but there are no official numbers yet. Back at the IDP camp, I speak with Daruro Hassan. The mother of 10 tells me 3 of her children died on the long journey to this camp. That was 5 months ago. Now she says she's still struggling to find food for herself and her surviving children. I'm very hungry, she tells me. My last meal was yesterday. She says she collects firewood and sells it at the local market to make a little money for food. It's often just enough to buy a cup of tea. The rainy season in Somalia usually starts in April, but UN officials worry that the expected rains won't be nearly enough to end this drought, meaning without more humanitarian aid, people across this region will continue to go hungry. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Luke, Somalia.
The phrase war crime has been uttered a lot recently. 15 years ago, those words were used to describe Darfur, the western region of Sudan. Entire villages wiped out by the Janjaweed militia. The atrocities in Darfur captured global attention. The United Nations raised the alarm. So did writers and celebrities who staged fundraisers to aid victims. Next week, the first trial related to crimes against humanity in Darfur will begin at the International Criminal Court. On trial will be the leader of the Janjaweed militia. Rebecca Hamilton joins me now. She's the author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action, and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Rebecca, who is the man on trial, Ali Kusheib, and what is he charged with?
Ali Kusheib, who these days prefers to be known by Ali Abdul Rahman, he was, as you said, a leader of the Janjaweed, the proxy militia force that the Sudanese government used in its genocidal atrocities against 4 Zaghawa and Masalit ethnic groups in Darfur. He wasn't just any Janjaweed leader, though. He was referred to by others and proudly proclaimed himself to be the colonel of the colonels.
And remind us, who was actually fighting whom and what were they fighting about?
So this was a conflict that is ongoing in many ways through to this day that was instigated by the Sudanese government using proxy militia drawn primarily from disenfranchised Arab tribes in the region and perpetrated against predominantly 4 Zaghawa and Masalit ethnicities, non-Arab groups in Darfur. And the then Sudanese president has an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court also out against him, Omar al-Bashir, and he is charged with genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes as part of the same conflict.
So, Rebecca, you know this story really well. How significant is it that Ali Kusheib is facing justice at the ICC?
This is an extraordinary moment for Darfuri survivors. This is the first time that they have had one of the perpetrators of the violence against them actually in the dock.
It has been a long time coming, this trial. The crimes Ali Khashoggi was charged with were committed almost 20 years ago. The first arrest warrant for him was issued in 2007. What has taken so long?
Well, it's very hard to actually get into your custody someone who doesn't want to be arrested, who has the protection of a government that doesn't want to see them arrested either. Now, what is really interesting about this story is the role that ordinary Sudanese people have actually played in bringing him to trial, because he was roaming free in Sudan for a long time. But in 2019, the Sudanese people overthrew Omar al-Bashir and the Sudanese government that was protecting him. And it was after that that he was fearful that the transitional government was going to arrest him. And so he fled to neighboring Central African Republic. And that is where he ultimately surrendered in 2020 and was able to be transferred to The Hague.
Mm. As this war crimes trial for this Janjaweed leader gets underway next week at the ICC, we're also hearing experts weigh in on whether war crimes are being committed by Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. Is a snail's pace of prosecuting the crimes committed in Darfur kind of a cautionary tale about prosecuting any possible war crimes committed in Ukraine?
I actually see this as a hugely optimistic tale. It is a sign that it is worth pursuing justice, even if in the moment of the crisis, it feels like it is impossible to get hold of these perpetrators, just as it feels to many people at the moment like it would be impossible to get hold of Putin. But the work needs to be done on the investigations, the evidence needs to be built up. And I think what the case of Ali Khashoggi shows is that you just cannot predict what the future will hold. And conditions can always change on the ground. That means that someone who had been able to evade accountability for perhaps decades will eventually be brought to justice.
When it takes so long to prosecute war crimes like this, it means war crimes can continue to be committed in Darfur, in Ukraine, wherever. What is the evidence that prosecuting war crimes will prevent them in the future?
The project of international criminal justice is still really very new in historical terms. And so we don't have a whole lot of really good evidence about the impact of deterrence. We get anecdotal evidence that people who are the frontline commanders on the ground may feel some deterrent impact by the threat of prosecution. But I think, you know, the jury is out. But certainly what we can say is that unless we're sending a message that these crimes will be prosecuted, then there's really no hope of deterrence, right?
Do you ever wonder, Rebecca, whether more efforts should be taken to prevent war crimes and crimes against humanity instead of waiting for the process of prosecution?
It's not an either or. We have to do both. And I actually think that one feeds into the other. If we hold people accountable for the atrocities that we commit, we send a signal that these are the norms that the international community is willing to uphold, and that feeds into a prevention cycle going forward.
Rebecca, is there any evidence that war crimes are still being committed in Darfur?
Certainly, we're seeing violence continuing to unfold on the ground. The legal definition of war crimes is pretty particular, so I wouldn't want to make a particular judgment on that. But I think certainly we are seeing acts that might be characterized as, if not war crimes, crimes against humanity.
You wrote a whole book about the struggle to prevent genocide in Darfur. What did you conclude about those efforts, and how do you see things today?
So at the time, as you mentioned, there was a huge mobilization of U.S. civil society to fight for the protection of the rights of people in Darfur. And unfortunately, it was a really hard conflict to resolve. And the U.S. was not the country that had the most leverage to resolve it. And I think over time, people got frustrated and tired of fighting when there didn't seem to be much progress. And I think that the lesson of this is that unless you have the people who are most directly affected at the core of your advocacy movement, then you're not going to be able to sustain it. It has been the Sudanese people themselves who have made the most difference to the situation in Darfur.
Rebecca Hamilton is the author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. She's also a law professor at American University's Washington College of Law. Rebecca, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marker.
This week, Egypt is getting a big influx of cash, billions of dollars in investments from wealthy regional neighbors, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar. Why? Well, the war in Ukraine has a lot to do with it. Joining me now to explain is Miret F. Mabrouk. She directs the Egypt program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Miret, explain how this investment money going to Egypt is tied to Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine has placed enormous strain. Egypt is the world's largest wheat importer. About 80% of that wheat comes from Russia and Ukraine. It hasn't been able to do that for a bit, so it's had to go diversify. That's going to raise prices. It has raised prices. Prices and inflation have shot up in Egypt. And generally speaking, the war is bad business. And Egypt was, looking to possibly get a loan anyway, but this has been extra impetus, if you like.
So can you explain briefly why wheat is so critical to Egypt's survival?
As we said, Egypt is the largest wheat importer in the world. Generally speaking, bread is extremely heavily subsidized in Egypt. The prices of bread hasn't changed in almost 35 years. And it's heavily subsidized because for a country that is about 30% below the poverty rate, that bread very often is the difference between you going to bed hungry and you going to bed having eaten. So it's essential for poorer people. And it is politically extremely sensitive in Egypt.
And have you seen episodes in Egypt's history where the price of bread changes and that results in major social upheaval?
Well, the price of bread hasn't changed in 35 years because it's likely to lead to major social upheaval. The last time we had anything like that was in 1977 under late President Anwar Sadat, who he announced that he was going to have to raise bread prices. What they got was about 48 hours of mass national rioting. He had to move all the way down to near the Sudanese border. And 2 days later, they decided that they were going to walk back that decision, and they kept the price of bread where it was.
So there is a lot of importance on the price of wheat. Are these investments enough to stabilize Egypt in the near term?
Oh, absolutely. Those investments came about for a couple of reasons. One being security. Egypt is often referred to as too big to fail, which is nonsense. No country is big enough is too big to fail, but the consequences of Egypt's failing in the region would be dreadful. And Egypt's security is part and parcel of the Gulf security. The other reason is, frankly, Egypt is just an excellent place to do business in the region. It has a thriving multinational culture, and those companies are extremely well run. It is a very good way to a place to do business, and they will get their money back in spades. But there's no doubt that the Ukraine war did give more of a nudge.
Do you think at some point Egypt will need to seek a loan from the International Monetary Fund?
It's already trying to do that. Now, it's a different kind of loan. And generally speaking, the IMF is there to provide loans to help countries with their balance of payment, which is exactly what Egypt needs at the moment. There had been talk that it might be looking into doing that before the Ukraine war, but I think there is no doubt that they're trying for that at the moment.
At the same time, Washington knows Egypt has a human rights problem. Does it make it harder for the U.S. to address those human rights concerns when Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE are sending Egypt billions with, security guarantees for them and a return on their investment?
Generally speaking, despite the U.S.'s concerns over human rights issues, and Egypt has significant human rights issues, there really isn't going to be very much that anyone is going to be able to do about. Egypt does not respond particularly well to the stick part of the carrot. It never has. And the changes that happen in the human rights field in Egypt are going to have to be done because Egypt needs to realize that improving its human rights file is important to its own security rather than any external pressure.
Miret F. Mabrouk is a senior fellow and director of the Egypt program at the Middle East Institute. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Miret, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
As the Russian military wages war in Ukraine, inside Russia, the government is clamping down even harder on its efforts to control the press. Using the word war or invasion, referring to the situation in Ukraine, is not tolerated in Russia. Moscow has also branded several publications as foreign agents or extremist organizations. Earlier this week, the country's last remaining independent newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, said it was suspending operations. To talk about the state of the media in Russia, I'm joined by Ivan Kolpakov. He's the editor-in-chief of Meduza, a Russian-language online news publication based in Latvia. He joins us from Riga. Ivan, describe the information space in Russia right now. How are people there getting information about the war in Ukraine?
Well, the situation really changed during the war. Russian authorities actually established military censorship in the first days of the war. The Russian state also blocked almost all the independent media outlets. Also, the authorities created this new law about so-called fakes regarding Russian army. You can't actually publish anything but the official information that comes from the Ministry of Defense. Otherwise, you can be prosecuted or even imprisoned. Within a couple of weeks, they destroyed everything. They ruined a very small independent sector of Russian journalism. Many outlets evacuated journalists abroad, as Medusa did, actually. Many media outlets just stopped the operation. This is a very concerning situation because the majority of Russian people now have no any access to the independent media. The only thing that left in the country is Russian propaganda.
Right now in Russia, for people who want information that is not controlled by the state, how can they get access to it?
Actually, people who want to get an independent information, they can do that because people learned how to use VPN, for example.
Virtual private network, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the gap between us and the huge part of society that actually prefers to watch television. Technologically, these people were cut off from internet. They don't have this experience of consuming news through internet.
The big news this week, we learned that Novaya Gazeta, edited by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Dmitry Muratov, was suspending operations, and that pretty much marks the end of all independent media in Russia. How significant is this news, even at a symbolic level?
It is a huge event, exactly on symbolic level, because Novaya Gazeta is the oldest Russian oppositional newspaper. And what is also important, when the war started, Novaya Gazeta decided to stay in the country. They did not evacuate people. They tried to cover the war. I think it was an impossible mission to cover the war and working under military censorship. However, they tried to do that. I admire their will to stay in the country, to stay in Moscow. And now it's over. It was predicted, and we all expected that it's going to happen, but now it's over. And it just breaks my heart. If you're a Russian journalist, it is an impossible event. But there is a context of the war. The war is also an impossible event for a huge part of Russian society, and for me as well. I mean, this is the catastrophe. This is the catastrophe for Ukrainians, but also it is the catastrophe for Russians. We need to reconsider everything we knew about ourselves. And we also, I think, need to reconsider the responsibility. We also need to think about the media we did. Did we do everything we had to do to stop the war? A lot of difficult questions we're asking ourselves right now.
Well, Ivan, as you watch what's happening in Ukraine from kind of over the horizon in Riga, Latvia, how has your mission at Medusa changed since this war started?
Well, for us, the most important thing to do right now is to cover the war. We need to show this war to Russian people through the eyes of Ukrainians. We need to try to spread this information as wide as possible. Because, unfortunately, I think that there is a huge part of Russian people who prefer to believe the television. Because they are in the stage of denial, because they can't accept that this horrible, impossible event actually happened. You only can change their opinion if you show them what's actually going on in Ukraine, that Russia actually destroying Mariupol and Chernihiv and Kharkiv and other Ukrainian cities and kills civilians. And it's really hard. It's not going to happen in one day. People are so attached to propaganda. So it's going to be a very difficult and painful and long trip. And it's not going to be easy, unfortunately. I'm not comforting myself thinking that it's going to be over tomorrow. No, my personal world was completely destroyed on 24th of February when the war started. But I have a privilege to work as a journalist, to do something that can be useful right now.
Ivan Kolpakov is the editor-in-chief of Medusa, a Russian-language online news publication based in Riga, the Latvian capital, speaking with us about Russia's media censorship. Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
If you're lucky enough to live in a place where cherry trees are blooming, you know how magical this season is. People across Japan are celebrating cherry blossoms in full bloom this week. In Tokyo's Shidorigafuchi Park, you can rent a boat and row right underneath the swaying branches of hundreds of trees weighed down with pink blossoms. Takanori Shiwaku owns a cafe in Tokyo. He told the Associated Press, "I feel like life has finally got back to normal." Cherry trees that come from Japan are a big tourist draw in Washington.
Such a beautiful day here in D.C. Peak bloom has finally arrived. It just started this afternoon. And
Washington's cherry blossoms reached their peak over a week ago on March 21st, 10 days ahead of schedule. A concern for scientists like Elizabeth Wolkovich. She's at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Wolkovich told the CBC that climate change has shifted the timing for most plants in the Northern Hemisphere to do their thing. And if there is one plant to study, it is the cherry blossom. Global fascination with the pink flowers dates back a long time, perfect for climate researchers.
Well, first of all, I should say cherry blossoms are one of the just most remarkable data sets out there. We have cherry blossom records from Japan going back to 800. The earliest cherry blossom record ever was actually last year.
Bad news wrapped up in a beautiful display and a lot of helpful data.
And so if we could better predict cherry blossoms, we know that we could use that knowledge to better predict many of the trees around us. And that would scale up to better global models of carbon sequestration and climate change itself.
Just another reason to be fascinated by the gorgeous cherry blossoms. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.